Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I've got a right to sing the blues. I got a right to feel low down. I got a right to hang around. Down around the river.
Turns out she did have a right to sing the blues. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the next hour, we look at the tumultuous career of Lena Horne. And Soundcheck CD picks of the week. And the indie hip-hop group Tanya Morgan joins us for a live performance. But first, with her delicate bone structure, copper skin, and satiny voice, on songs like I Got a Right to Sing the Blues, which you're hearing now, Lena Horne became Hollywood's first black star. But according to a new biography, the Grammy and Tony-winning singer paid an enormous price for her victories. James Gavin is the author of Stormy Weather, The Life of Lena Horne, and he joins us here in our Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
So good to be here, John.
So she was an icon, but there was a real person underneath that icon, and that can be a tough balancing act for many people. How is it to write about the person behind this kind of legend?
It's so interesting that you began with that song, I Got a Right to Sing the Blues, because a lot of people thought Lena Horne had no right to sing the blues. Anyone who's that beautiful, why should we feel sorry for them? Anyone who is that seemingly privileged, who is always plucked out of the background and put into the foreground, who is chosen to be Hollywood's first black goddess on screen, who reigns in the most glamorous white supper clubs in America, why should we feel sorry for that person? Lena Horne, whom I interviewed once in 1994, described her life in those years as living in a black ivory tower, apart from a lot of the brutal realities that people of her race had to face. But prior to that, in the early 40s, she was chosen by the NAACP and by MGM to revolutionize the black image in Hollywood, which up until that
time, sounds like an unholy alliance, MGM and the NAACP?
Well, Walter White, who was the leader of the NAACP at that time, saw in Lena Horne an in with Hollywood. He saw someone who was gorgeous in a Caucasian fashion and who could seduce white America into thinking differently about black people, who up until that time on screen were given every stereotype you can name. And Lena Horne stepped onto a pedestal at that point, and she became a kind of icon. She had to behave impeccably from that point on, and she had to please white people, she had to please black people. There was no middle ground, and boy, is that some pressure.
Well, you write that Lena Horne herself was, quote, taught to lie, unquote. And it seems like, from her own autobiography, it seems like after a number of years of telling these stories that they become truth, at least to her. So how do you wring out the genuine truth from this kind of mythology that has accrued over the years?
Happily, Lena talked a lot all her life. She began giving interviews in the late 30s and gave them until the late 90s. And Lena's truth always came out in one way or the other. I could look at early versions of stories and see how they morphed with retellings into a more correct version, a version that fit the image that she was supposed to uphold all those years. And
so each story would fall in with the bigger narrative that was supposed to be going.
Yes, and by the time that I got to her, I interviewed her for a New York Times piece on the dawn of her last renaissance in 1994. And I, at that time, was 30 years old, and Lena was 76. And at that point, she just seemed to me very vulnerable and very unguarded and in no mood to maintain the old facade. And I felt and still feel, having done all this research, that she really leveled with me that day. And I used that as the touchstone for this book.
The book is called Stormy Weather, The Life of Lena Horne. The black singer who, according to band leader Artie Shaw, sang white. What did that mean? Well, listen, and you can perhaps hear for yourself.
I know he won't be glad to see me without a penny to the good. But I'm not caring much what happens. I did the best I could. He's just good for nothing, Joe. But oh, I love him so. Guess I'd die if good for nothing, Joe, ever tried to leave me flat. Oh, yes, I'm certain of that.
That is a 1941 recording by singer Lena Horne. Good for Nothing Joe is the name of the song, and we're speaking with James Gavin, author of the new biography called Stormy Weather, The Life of Lena Horne.
Check out today's Soundcheck blog.
Lena Horne's racial ambiguity must have been an unsettling thing for people to deal with back in the 30s and 40s, but I wonder if it also helped her career. She didn't sound black, for example, and to this day, people grow up hearing her version of Stormy Weather and, like me, maybe well into adulthood before learning that she was, in fact, African American.
For the rest of the story, visit the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org.
James, I mean, you know, the idea of this racial ambiguity, you know, she couldn't be black enough for black America, white enough for white America, and yet for people who just heard that voice coming over the radio, questions like that, I mean, I don't recall growing up as a kid even wondering, wow, is this woman white or black or what? I mean, you heard Stormy Weather, it was Lena Horne, and even if you saw a picture sometimes you didn't know, it was still ambiguous. That, too, is a big part of this narrative.
That was another fascinating song choice. That was with Charlie Barnett's orchestra, with whom she sang for a few months in 1941, a white band leader who worshipped Duke Ellington and had many black influences in his style. And there was Lena singing in perfect Anglo-style diction.
Even when the G is missing from nothing, nothing. Beautiful, beautifully enunciated, even with the G appropriately taken out.
Now, that song, of course, is about a prostitute on the street with no business, worried that her man is going to beat her up when she goes home. It's the song of probably a black woman. And yet, Lena is singing it in a style that was perfectly suited to Cole Porter, to George Gershwin. Very few black singers of the day were in that territory. Ethel Waters before Lena Horne was, yes.
What was her upbringing? I mean, was her family, they weren't completely African American?
Well, she was born in what has been called the black bourgeoisie of Brooklyn, which was a very educated, cultivated, upwardly mobile, small minority of black people. She was born in 1917. And this was a family that was very, very image conscious and very focused on getting a good education and making their way in white society. And racial identity for them and for most of black America was such a messy, blurry thing at that time. And Lena was schooled by various teachers like Noble Sissel, the band leader, whom she joined after she left the Cotton Club in the mid-30s. She was brought up and schooled to be a lady, to have impeccable manners, grace, to speak beautifully, superbly, all of those things. And these are qualities, for better or worse, that made her more palatable to white America, mm-hmm. because they flew in the face of all the cliches and stereotypes that were associated with black people.
Which is fine. You know, breaking down stereotypes is great as far as it goes, but for a young Lena Horne growing up in a black neighborhood with the kids chanting, you know, yellow, yellow at you, you have a white daddy and all that kind of stuff, must have been confusing as well as hurtful.
Sure. She was dragged out of this upscale Brooklyn family setting and brought through the deep, brutal Deep South in the 1920s by her mother, who wanted to be an actress and had gone down south in order to search for work. And people did not know what to make of this pretty little Caucasian-looking girl. All these issues of skin tone and racial identity at that time were such sensitive issues that Lena did not know how to deal with. You're absolutely right.
So you talk about, you know, after the Cotton Club getting, you know, some helping hands from within the industry. Those looks of hers, they must have opened a lot of doors.
Well, in those days, if you were a black person, the less threatening you were to white people, the farther off you were going to go, unless... No, this did not come under the umbrella of a threat. If you could sing great, tap dance great, if you were Cotton Club material, then you were in. But you were in that little pocketed area as someone who was there to entertain white people. That's what the Cotton Club was about. The Cotton Club were the creme de la creme of black talent in shows that were largely created by white people for white people. And Lena would not have gotten into that Cotton Club chorus line if she had not been beautiful in that Caucasian mold that they were looking for, and she would certainly not have gotten a foot in the door of MGM.
So how did that play out in terms of the kind of racism that she did face, even with those Caucasian looks?
Well, if she was down south on USO tours, because one of her great pride and joy activities of the war years was to go and entertain the black troops and to be their personal sweetheart. She would find herself at a coffee counter and getting no service, getting ignored completely. Didn't matter that she was Lena Horne. Didn't matter that she was a movie star. All that mattered was that people could see that she was black, and that meant that she was inferior.
Okay, you use the term movie star, James. Is that really appropriate for someone who, you know, was used in a very kind of specific way on the screen, in a way that could easily be edited out when those movies were played in the South?
She starred in two movies in her MGM years, Cabin in the Sky and Stormy Weather.
Over
at Fox. Now, those were fluff roles, but they were lead roles. Star, no, certainly not a star in the sense that Gene Kelly or even June Allison or Catherine Grayson got to be stars at MGM, but star in the sense that she was among MGM's elite, which was the most elite in musical comedy Hollywood that could possibly be. And even in those 5, 3, 4 minute turns that she did in those movies, she was given the full star treatment, as much so as Rita Hayworth or anyone else that you can name. And those little moments made a big impression.
Now, she had some powerful allies, Louis B. Mayer, the director Vincent Minnelli. Why was she not able to get to that with her looks and her voice? Why was she not able to get to that kind of A-list? Was it simply that despite the looks, she was black?
They made a number of efforts, they being MGM, to incorporate her into those films, but it was difficult because she did not have a black romantic leading man counterpart to play off of. So how are you going to fit Lena Horne into a story with a bunch of white people? There were very practical risks in those days, and MGM could not single-handedly revolutionize race relations in this country.
She wanted, Lena Horne did, the role of Julie in Showboat. She didn't get it. Ava Gardner got it. And they told Ava Gardner to listen to Lena Horne recordings to figure out, you know, the kind of singing that they wanted for this role.
For someone like Lena, for whom alienation and rejection were hot buttons, things that she had grown up with and was very, very sensitive to, she never got over that MGM rejection as she saw it. She wanted that part more than life itself. There were very, again, practical reasons why they could not give it to her. For one thing, and this is never mentioned, but it must be mentioned, the revelation of the character Julie's mixed race in that story is pivotal to the story. It's a climactic point, and you simply cannot cast a black actress in the role of a woman who is successfully passing. So there's that point. And then more serious is the fact that there were still miscegenation laws in Hollywood, which meant that although you could depict a mixed race relationship in the story, if you had a black actor and a white actor playing these parts, that was still against the law.
Well, as I say, Lena Horne was the model that MGM executives asked Ava Gardner to practice to when they gave her the role of Julie. Here is Lena Horne and her Touchstone recording.
Up in the sky, stormy weather, since my man and I ain't together, keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere. Stormy weather, just can't get my poor self together. I'm weary all the time, the time. So weary all the time. When he went away, the blue.
That is Lena Horne, Brooklyn's own Lena Horne, and Stormy Weather, classic recording from her. The book is called Stormy Weather, The Life of Lena Horne by my guest James Gavin. And, you know, with all of the things you've been talking about, the, you know, this kind of pernicious racism, even for someone who has reached the level of fame and wealth of a Lena Horne, it kind of makes sense that this would spill over into her personal life, in her relationships with her husbands and lovers and friends. In the index in the back of the book, Friends Discarded By runs to 10 pages. I mean, what was it with her and you know, her inability apparently to kind of keep her friends close?
I think that it was defensiveness. I think that someone who had felt so terribly rejected, whose father had deserted the family early on, who felt like excess baggage to a mother who was more intent on becoming a star in the 1920s. These things made a searing impression on this little girl, and you just don't get over those things. So the reflex of pushing people away before they can hurt you becomes second nature.
Now, you said that when you interviewed Lena Horne, was it 1994, that you felt she was tired of the facade, she sort of bared her soul in a manner of speaking. What was happening all those years before, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, even the 60s when she's getting into the civil rights movement? Is she still kind of living this double life?
Yes. Up until that time, all through those years, was the sheer exhaustion of having to please everybody, of having to carry a very heavy mantle of being a symbol on her shoulders. And what this means is that you can't be a human being. You are not allowed to make normal human being mistakes. And this, to this moment, is true with our icons, especially with our minority icons, because they're not allowed the latitude of making human mistakes. They are the chosen ones, and they have to behave perfectly.
Are you talking about people like Chris Brown, for example, with the whole Rihanna mess, when you say minority icons? And
well, is he an icon?
Yeah, Michael Jackson, maybe?
The president. I mean, he can't please anybody no matter what he does. He gets beaten up on for every move he makes. He is the chosen one. Everyone has, there's a certain condescension in it, I find. You know, okay, we have chosen this black or semi-black man as our leader. He better not make a mistake. Lena Horne was very much in that same position.
So there was a lot of kind of bitterness, of anger, and yet you write that she was able to kind of turn that anger to put it to use when she was out on stage.
Yes, the Lena Horne of the Waldorf Astoria, this haughty, brittle, very sophisticated, distant, chilly, fiery black woman, ferocious black woman. It was seductive and it was off-putting at the same time. This was not somebody that you could get close to. You could worship her. But talk about being up on a pedestal. She was glamorous. She was chic. She was untouchable.
Did you actually see her?
Oh, dear, no. That was years before I was born. But I saw her in later incarnations. I saw her in her one-woman show on Broadway twice.
Because she had that one-woman show called Lena Horne, The Lady and Her Music, which won a Tony. She won a couple of Grammys. It was the longest, I think it still is, the longest-running solo show on Broadway.
Yes.
But you quote her as saying it was too little, too late.
Can you imagine? But I had a friend, he died sadly, Gene Davis, a wonderful black documentary filmmaker, and he gave me his blessing to do this book early on. It gave me the courage to do it, I have to tell you, because I was scared of telling this story. And Gene told me, and I've quoted him in the book as saying that for someone like Lena, so much had gone down so early on, so much hurt, so much, again, rejection, that nothing else that happened, no amount of accolades or glory was ever going to make up for it.
Does that explain this final act of her life, that of the recluse? I mean, she's been nowhere, seen no one for like 10 years now.
Yes, almost 10 years, it's true. She withdrew. She, in 2000, in fact, was the year that she did her last little performance, and then she was out of there, and she has disappeared ever since. We haven't seen her or heard a word from her.
And yet her legacy lives on. You know, at this point, we can look at a Halle Berry or a Beyoncé, and we can talk about what they do as opposed to who they are. You know, that's not the first thing we talk about anymore.
Absolutely.
And that is in large measure due to Lena Horne, the subject of James Gavin's biography, Stormy Weather, The Life of Lena Horne. James, it is a fascinating and very stormy story. Thanks for telling some of it for us today.
It's a joy. Thank you, John.
And know you're right, because the time will come around when you'll say it's yours.
That is Lena Horne from her one-woman show, The Lady and Her Music, from 1981. Up next on Soundcheck, music from Brazil, Iceland, and Brooklyn in Soundcheck's CD Picks of the Week. And later, the indie hip-hop trio known as Tanya Morgan gives a shout-out to Brooklyn and to Cincinnati in their music. They'll play live in our Soundcheck studio.
That's where I would be.